Hello, everyone, and welcome to episode 38 of the Theatrical Mustang podcast. I'm your host, Katie Woodzik. This episode is with Shakespearean leading lady, Alina Hodges, and it is a fantastic conversation going through Shakespeare's different plays and how we look at gender and portraying it in Shakespeare's plays, and talking about Island Shakespeare Festival and the journey that she's gone on over the past 6 seasons, also her work with Circle in the Square and Southern Oregon University. And so this was a delightful, delightful episode, and I feel like you could not go to Shakespeare class a couple days in school after listening to this. Maybe don't pay attention to that. Maybe don't follow that advice. So Shakespeare, Island Shakespeare Festival, Three Musketeers and The Tempest run in repertory through the middle of September. Visit islandshakespearefest.org for more information and what shows are playing on what dates. They've moved this year, so they're actually going to be, instead of at the middle school, they're at near the primary school in this great field. There's lots of banners. You can't miss it. Free Shakespeare. Check it out. This episode is sponsored by Second Street Hair Boutique, located in the heart of Langley. Second Street Hair Boutique has all your needs taken care of for feeling foxy and awesome. Cuts, colors, balayage, eyebrow tinting and waxing. You can visit secondstreethairboutique.com to learn more and book an appointment with Natasha, Hava, or Bristol. So, please enjoy episode 38 with Alina Hodges. I'm very excited to welcome seasoned actress Alina Hodges to the podcast. Welcome.
Thank you. I'm excited to be here.
So you are doing 2 shows in rep this summer with ISF, yes. Island Shakespeare Festival. You're a founding company member. Mm-hmm. Why don't you tell me a little bit about this awesome journey you've gone over the past 5 years with this company?
Yeah, it has been so exciting to be a part of. I guess I got involved because I had just graduated from Circle in the Square Theater School in New York and was not sure of my next steps and came home the summer of 2010. And a woman who had moved to the island pretty recently was thinking she wanted to do some Shakespeare. And my mom was kind of helping her facilitate some of the, like, getting community support and helping that happen. And so I auditioned for her and was cast as Rosalind in As You Like It in our inaugural season. And we had, I mean, I carried my costumes around in my car. We had our, we were in the middle of the woods that season at a beautiful location called Storyhouse Theater. And yeah, they had, it's a natural amphitheater there, and so that is how Rosie met the Hulls, who, Rose Woods, our artistic director, met the Hull family who owned that land, and there's a natural amphitheater there, so they were interested in building a stage, and so she was like, oh, come do some Shakespeare in the woods if you want to build a stage. So that's how that happened, and we had no idea what to expect our first season. It's a hike to get up to that land.
Yes, it is.
As you know, it is, it's in the middle of the woods, and I remember our first performance, we had, like, a circle backstage, and Rosie said, you know, if we have as many people in the audience as we have on stage, we're doing the show, and it's going to be great. And just after she said that, we were told to stay backstage. This was maybe 3:30, and there were already people showing up for our, maybe it must have been earlier, because I think our show was at 4, so it was probably 2:30 or so, and there were already people lining up to see our Shakespeare play in the woods, and that was the beginning, and we've had nothing but incredible support since then. We outgrew that space, which was really hard to say goodbye to. We spent 3 years there.
Yes.
So we did As You Like It the first year, and then Romeo and Juliet the second year, and Midsummer Night's Dream was our final season on that land. And then we moved to the Langley Middle School property and had two seasons there. And now we are in a new home on Max Walton Road in the field next to the primary school. And that's we're loving being there, and it feels far enough away from the rest of Langley that we are kind of a little oasis there, but close enough that it's easy for people to get to, easy to find. So that's been really positive. So I started, I guess, with ISF as an actor in 2010 and have been back every year. After our first season, I went to Ashland, Oregon to finish my degree in my undergraduate degree in acting, but came back every summer to do some Shakespeare wherever we were going to be.
Let's inside the actor's studio this a little bit. Take us year through year, your roles, whether on stage or supporting off stage.
So 2010, I played Rosalind, which was, it was the first full-length Shakespeare play.
You may hear Brody the dog giving a little bit of actor commentary in the background.
He's the cutest ever. So that was my first full-length Shakespeare play, and I played Rosalind, which was an incredible experience, and I fell in love with Shakespeare when I was a tiny child, but that was the first time I got to really dive into a role, and it was amazing. And then in 2011, I got to fulfill my lifelong dream of playing Juliet, and still my favorite role I've ever played for so many reasons, and might always be, will certainly always be one. The arc she has is so incredible.
Do you want to dig into that a little bit?
Sure.
Let's dig into that a little bit.
Okay, yeah. It's such a cliche having Romeo and Juliet be your favorite play, but that is the, those are the words that made me choose this career path. My mom had me, as a little girl, watch the Franco Zeffirelli Romeo and Juliet when I was so young. I don't know, like, why that was instead of a, you know, Disney movie she put on.
No. These are young kids really getting it on.
Yeah, really intense.
Dying. This is appropriate.
Play. But I loved it. I don't know what spoke to me in that movie, but I just loved it and went as Juliet / really I went as Olivia Hussey because I just thought she was so beautiful for Halloween when I was like maybe six.
That's amazing.
So it's been a lifetime journey getting to Juliet. I, you know, would like run around the house as a little kid pretending I was her and doing the balcony scene by myself or with my dad. I would have like, I had like an abridged version and would.
Your adaptation.
Yeah. My dad built a balcony when I was a kid off our, the second story of our house. And so not for me to play Juliet. This was a separate project that he decided to do, but it helped me fulfill that, fantasy life of being Juliet. So that was a really exciting season for me. She starts off, the story is this feisty little kid who, you know, doesn't want to talk about boys and just wants to, you know, be 12.
Right.
She's 12. And then, you know, it's a totally heightened world. She meets this boy and falls in love with him one night. 2 days later, they're married, and the next day, they're dead. So, okay, like, maybe a little bit unrealistic lifetime, but there's so much passion, and it's just so beautiful. It's so beautiful. The first time Romeo and Juliet speak to each other, it's almost a perfect sonnet. Like, killing me, Shakespeare. Killing me here. That is so cool. there's so much in that play that I just think is incredible. And then to play this kid and then to get to discover that moment of falling in love and what that's like. I remember the first moment I first fell in love in my lifetime. And it's like, whoa!
Yeah.
Oh my God, what just happened?
You don't realize that you're capable of feeling that strongly for something outside of yourself.
Yeah. It's psycho. It's totally weird. And I was, 14 and it was shocking and like really disturbing. And so then she has this whole scene where she thinks she's in private, like talking about this young man she's just met and fallen in love with, but oh my gosh, dang it. We will never be together because our families hate each other. That sucks so much. And then he's there. He's right there in front of her. Like, it's so intense. It's so good. It's just so good.
It's just one of those really universal stories, right?
It is.
I mean, when you think of, I don't know, the top five plays that people know, period. I mean, Romeo and Juliet is definitely in that list.
Yes. Yeah. And for good reason. I think we forget that because we are taught it in, ninth grade when we're all just
over it,
don't want to identify with it. And
I'm remembering this. I remember being in ninth grade advanced English. Uh-huh. We were reading Romeo and Juliet, and it was the scene where they're arguing about what kind of bird it is.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
You know, it's the lark. It's, it's the bird that heralds evening or morning. And I remember, getting really into it because I was such a theater geek and everyone else laughing because I'm like, no, my love. Oh, and being this awkward ass 14-year-old and the kids in the room, not being able to handle that, someone yes, I want to take on this intensity. And I also think there's something about, modern culture where we're not supposed to be vulnerable.
Totally.
Ever.
Yes.
And Romeo and Juliet really exposes vulnerability in all these different forms, mm-hmm. A parent's love, brotherly love, mm-hmm. All of this stuff.
Absolutely. Yeah. And loyalty and the first time you have to betray your family and in doing that, both of those children become adults. That's the first time I think for either of them that they're going against what they know. And in a person's life, when do you become a grown up? When does that happen? And I think that's a huge moment for them. And it's such a good play. Wow. And those characters are so good.
And one of the things I really appreciate about Rose as a director is I love the take that she took, both on that, and I think there's a parallel with the way that she approached The Tempest in having it be more of a matriarchal system. And I think that I love that she's opened to, making those shifts in casting. Uh-huh. I saw this article recently. There's a group called Trans Shakespeare talking about how, begin the conversation with Shakespeare was always fluid in who was being cast in what roles because he only had men to work with. And so, quote unquote purists who say, oh, no, you can only cast it a certain way. They're missing the whole point.
Right. It's really funny. We had one audience member for Tempest who was so offended about a female Trinculo and Stefano, a female Caliban, a female Prospero. And it's like, okay, but what about in Shakespeare's day when it was all men? It's really funny. It really messes with people. And
we'll get to we're kind of going all over the place, but I love it. I'm not a linear person at all. But you were in an all-female cast of Two Gentlemen of Verona.
Yeah.
At Oregon Shakespeare Festival.
Talk about messing with people's...
And actually, when they talk, I was lucky enough to have Kathy Shett on the podcast, and she works with the Seattle Office of Arts and Culture and doing a lot of racial equity training around casting in Seattle.
Oh, cool.
And she was talking about Oregon Shakespeare as a company who has really taken it upon themselves in both gender and racial equity in their casting to be a nationwide leader in that. And so I was wondering if you could talk to being in that environment and what it was like to be a part of that all-female cast.
It was incredible. it's such a masculine story, and really is these total bros who just are bros and have no idea how to deal with women. It's like, reading the text is just like, oh my god, are these, like, what are they saying? It's so atrocious sometimes. But to tackle that as women brought, from our first read through, brought a really interesting kind of poignancy that I think can be missed when you have that gender divide. And because we're really used to hearing words like that in mainstream media and in our culture come from men. Like, it's not weird right. for there to be on a show or in a movie or in a play, men talking about women as objects and, you know, just.
And the daily sex is, I remember walking in Pioneer Square where I work about half of the time, like, I remember last week being struck by walking three blocks and being hit on twice. And I'm like, I mean, it's rare that that happens that much, but I'm like, this is like, we deal with this
all the time,
every day,
all the time.
And I mean, yeah. I chose not to engage. I just chose not to hear yeah. either of them because I didn't want that moment of confrontation, but
yeah, but you know, sometimes you just can't avoid it. It's really, yeah, it's so ingrained in our culture. And so to hear
women saying those words
that we've all heard men say to us, we've all heard men say that, you know, but to hear it from women who are bringing to it their experience from the other side. And yeah, it was really interesting.
Do you think there's a bit of catharsis
yeah.
in that?
Yeah, I do.
I was having,
definitely.
I had a callback earlier this week where Michael Morgan and I were doing an improv as a Scottish innkeeper and his wife. And it was funny because I'm terrified by improv. Like,
I'm so bad at
I
improv.
I want the lines. But yeah. I'm like, oh,
I need someone to tell me what to do. Like,
I'm going to do this. So what happened was the director was like, okay, Michael, you play the husband. And No, Michael, you play the wife and Katie, you play the husband. And Michael hadn't quite grokked that. Because, I mean, it's a high stress environment in a callback, yeah. right? and so what was so interesting was that we both thought we were the husband. And we both did the improv as though we were the husband.
Oh, wow.
And so he got to this point. And so I was defaulting to these really sexist kind of things. Mm-hmm. And so he said, like, you know, I'm not going to do the Scottish accent because it was terrible. But he was like, where's my steak? And I'm like, if you want a steak, you're going to have to cook it up yourself uh-huh. in the kitchen like women folk do. Mm-hmm. At the end, someone who was watching and, you know, an extra set of eyes for the director was like, a female actress is like, that was cathartic for me, uh-huh. like, watching that. How is that for you?
Yeah.
And the power of words, right? Things that we become sort of deaf to because we've heard them so much coming out of, you know, one kind of person and then completely having a different meaning and challenging us to think critically mm-hmm. in an all-female cast mm-hmm. of Two Gentlemen of Verona.
Yeah, we had some really interesting rehearsals early on where we, you know, explored masculinity and the different ways that that's expressed and what it feels like to just have, there's inherent power in being a man. There just is.
You take up more space.
You take up
naturally
and unconsciously. You hold yourself differently.
Right.
And it was so fun to get to explore that and to like pretend to have a penis and walk differently because
right.
of that. And yeah, it was so trippy. But within those rehearsals, we knew that in playing these characters, we were not playing caricatures of men. We are women. We have female bodies. And that's great. That's what we have. What we were playing are the words and the circumstances. And so it never was that any of us were, like, really trying to play men. Right. You're just playing these humans that are, have these relationships, and some have a masculine story that they're telling and some have a feminine story that they're telling, and how those, come together. And it was really interesting in the final scene. It's a really hard scene to deal with, I think, for modern audiences, because it is...
I'm not familiar with the play. Could you give a little bit of context?
Okay, so in the play, there are these two gentlemen. We use the term gentlemen.
They're the bros.
Very loosely. There are these two bros, and one of them's name is Proteus, and one of them's name is Valentine. And Valentine gets... sent away from Verona to, like, go to college, except not go to school, but, you know, go away from home, get some life
experience. That would
experience.
Be the cultural reference point.
Yeah, so that's kind of how we thought of it. He's going to go off to college, and he meets this lady named Sylvia, who's, like, super hot and amazing, and he falls madly in love with her, and she's betrothed to this other dude who's, like,
Not the
greatest, but her dad, who's the Duke, wants her to marry this other guy, Thurio. And, meanwhile, Proteus is in love with this lady, Julia, back home in Verona, but Proteus really, really misses Valentine and is just super bummed about it. But also really, really loves Julia and wants to stay with Julia. But his dad is like, I think we're going to send you off to hang with Valentine, because you should also go away
right. And
do your own thing for a while. So Proteus is really sad to leave Julia, but super stoked to go chill with Valentine. So he gets to, I think they go to probably Milan. They all go to Milan. They go to Milan or something, and Proteus meets Sylvia. And Proteus is like, oh shit, I'm going to steal that Sylvia from Valentine. So then there's this, like, awful love triangle, and Sylvia's gonna leave and, like, run off and elope with Valentine, and then Proteus tells the dad about this plan, and so Valentine gets banished, and Sylvia goes to find him in the woods. Meanwhile, Valentine's become the, like, leader of these outlaws, which is really fun. Julia has followed them all into the woods, so she's dressed as a boy, of course, because, you know, it's Shakespeare. So the girl's gonna dress up like a dude. And so at the end, they've all come together and are, you know, Valentine is super mad at Proteus.
Right.
And Proteus tries to rape Sylvia, and it's like, yeah,
whoa.
All this stuff. And so the way it is written... The way it's generally interpreted is that Proteus rapes Sylvia, that happens, super lame, Valentine forgives him, they become bros again, and Julia marries Proteus, and Valentine marries Sylvia. So everyone ends up with who they're supposed to end up with in the end, and the women have no words in the last scene. There's nothing. So... Yeah, it's, like, really hard to, for a whole female cast to wrap our brains around that.
We just totally skip over the right part.
Yeah, it's, like, so not what any of us would do.
Right.
So the women who were playing Julia and Sylvia had a really tough time with, like, okay, I know that is the text, kind of, but... Just because they don't have any lines, like, can we have something? So I think that the solution was so beautiful. And Proteus asks Julia's forgiveness, and Proteus says, like, I give you my hand or something like that. And Julia's last line is, and I mine. And so that's supposed to be them making up, maybe.
Right.
But it was really interesting. Erica Sullivan, my idol, she's so, so, so talented, and just, it was amazing to work with her. But she, every night, it was a little bit different, and sometimes she forgave him, and sometimes she didn't, and she got to take all the time she needed before. So there was, you know, several seconds of a pause before she decided, am I going to give him my hand tonight? Am I not? It was so powerful. And she got to reclaim that and you know, have it be her choice if she's going to go off with him or not. And what happens after the curtain? Who knows? Maybe they're friends eventually. Maybe not. Maybe they have a happy marriage. I don't know. But just
He's sounding real sure about that.
But just taking that power and redefining what that scene is.
Right.
You know, was like really cool. And getting to tell our own story with it. It was really
Can you talk a little bit more about being in that environment at OSF? And
yeah.
So you were, it was sort of a natural progression from the Southern Oregon.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. The culmination of the BFA program at Southern Oregon University is the opportunity to audition for an internship with the Shakespeare Festival. So that is what I did and, was cast in Two Gents, which we refer to as No Gents. Except, actually, the dog in the... There's Lance, the character, has a dog, and the dog was a boy from Whidbey Island, turns out. His name's Picasso. He's the cutest. I know. Well, weird. Yeah, he's a waif dog. Yeah, but... so that's how... That is what happened. And I understudied The Sign in Sidney Brustein's Window as well. And it's... Yeah, it's a really cool company to... To be a part of.
Did you see any of the casting process as well? I mean, just in terms of the way that they're really leading the way for the, you know, racial and gender equity kind of stuff. You're seeing it play out.
I am seeing it play out, definitely. It's a hard subject to talk about because I don't know how much... Like, I definitely see what they tend to do every year in terms of diversity and having representation from different cultural groups and ethnic groups. And I think that's really, really, really wonderful and important, especially in Ashland, Oregon, which is...
Really white?
White. So white. Yeah.
The whitest.
The whitest.
Right.
Like, whoa. Yeah. So it's wonderful to bring that there. And then to also, they also, part of their education program brings students from marginalized parts of the Northwest and beyond to
see shows.
And so that again is different ethnic groups and different cultural demographics. It's really, really cool that I think what they're doing is amazing. I got to be a part of the audition process for this season in that I was a reader for some of the callbacks.
Oh, fantastic.
Which was really cool and
such a great opportunity to be a fly on the wall with nothing to lose.
So cool.
Right?
Yeah. Yeah. And they had people read for roles on didn't matter what color you are. Read for roles. I think it is important in the way they cast to, in the final product, have different people represented. So, you know, depending on who they choose for a certain role and what that person looks like, that's going to determine who they choose for the other role.
Right.
And what that person looks like. Naturally. Which is what it would be if they were casting all white people. It still matters. Like, your looks... matter.
Right.
It matters based on how the story is going to be told.
It's very visual medium.
It is. This
theater.
So you go watch a play. There's people on stage that you're looking at. So, you know, that's part of the storytelling.
Right.
So, for example, when they did Midsummer Night's Dream a few years ago, the four lovers each... were a visual representation of a different ethnic group. So they had
so great.
Yeah, they had I have to think about who played what.
I can't remember who, what
the roles were, but four different ethnic groups were represented within the Lovers, and same thing this year in Much Ado About Nothing. So I think...
What a fantastic segue, right?
Oh, yeah, Much Ado About Nothing.
Oh, but we skipped over but we were just talking about Midsommar.
Too, yeah.
Because okay, I'm like, right. I feel like that's a good way to get
totally
back on track, yeah, looping
wow,
back
look
around.
At you having a track. That's awesome.
Oh, yeah.
Because I do not.
So we're going back to the Lovers.
Yeah.
Midsummer Night's Dream steampunk interpretation.
That was so fun. We just had so much fun in that show.
So this is my question for you.
Great.
Because I think sometimes... My beef with Shakespeare is sometimes the ingenue parts are, I just feel like they don't get enough meat to them. And I know Helena's different because she gets to have a little bit more fire under her ass. Yes, I said ass. I can say whatever I want on my own podcast. But how do you as
a
strong
said penis
young...
Earlier.
You said right. Penis. That's fine. Ass, penis.
It's referring to a real penis. Well, my pretend. Okay. Anyway,
How do you like as an intelligent young woman in modern society? How do you reconcile yourself sometimes to playing these parts where the power balance is not what one would want it to be, but still honoring this legacy of amazing literature?
Yeah.
Like, how do you find that balance?
I find the balance in the text, and how some people decide to play Shakespeare's ingenues is up to them, but in the text, there is plenty of room for fire and sass. So much room. Rosalind, fiery, sassy, amazing female character. And... what Shakespeare gives so many of his women is the opportunity to dress as a man and test that out and see what it's like. And that is so cool. So I think there's tons of room. Juliet, too. Juliet is so often, you know, this little like, Romeo, I just am so weak and sad and, I'm going to die now. And
so it's sort of going against what the, not necessarily the text itself, because the stuff is in the text, but the cultural expectations of how these characters have been represented over time.
Totally. There's so, all of Shakespeare's women fight. That's why we still do these plays, is because they're all fighters and don't settle for the status quo. Helena runs off into the forest to pursue the man she loves who doesn't want her. He does not want her, but she's not going to take no for an answer. Should she in that historical context? Probably. But she doesn't. And in the end, she gets him, so ha. So, you know, I feel like, yeah, the ingenue can be demure and weak, but she doesn't have to be. And... Hermia, too. Hermia is, like, really even more the ingenue than Helena.
Right, right.
And
absolutely.
What's Hermia doing? She's running away from her dad. She's saying, no, dude, you're not going to control me and make me marry someone who I don't want to marry. Right?
Right.
Like, there's so much to play with there. I just, yeah, I don't have a hard time finding
you're kind of like, suck it, society.
Yeah.
Change your preconceptions of what these characters
totally.
Should be. I
yep.
love it.
Yeah.
So from Helena to Beatrice.
Yeah.
One of my favorite characters.
Me too.
In all of Shakespeare.
Absolutely.
And so that was the first move to Langley.
Mm-hmm.
We have a circus tent.
Yeah.
We're doing a circus theme.
Yep.
And you are a knife throwing.
Yes.
Beatrice.
Except actually, I was supposed to be a knife thrower, but I couldn't learn how to throw knives. Because actually, that's like really hard and
dangerous.
And we had 3 weeks of rehearsal.
And so they were like metal cards.
They were metal cards, which
is really cool.
Still amazing that no one lost any blood, really, with those, because they didn't always stick in my board. Sometimes they would ricochet.
Shakespeare
but
unplugged.
I don't think anyone was injured during the making of Much
Ado About Nothing. To the best of my recollection.
So, it was okay. But, yeah, that was so, so much fun. And that context gave plenty of room for Beatrice to really...
Right.
Be a force to be reckoned with, I think. Yeah, that was a lot of fun. The move was hard for us. It was really, we were sad to leave, the land for right. sure, but it was also really exciting to be more on, like, the tourism radar and kind of start
being more accessible.
Yeah. Yeah. Easier for people to get to. And we could accommodate our growing audience, which was great. So
why do you think, companies like ISF, you know, there's Green Stage and Seattle. I mean, all over the world, there are these outdoor Shakespeare festivals, some for free, some not so. Why do you think it strikes a cultural nerve that people, like, want to take their whole families out to see Shakespeare, want to make it an event in numbers that kind of make indoor theater... I mean, like, there's just... It's exponentially better attended than indoor theater.
Mm-hmm. Well, certainly, I mean, it's... Our mission statement is, you know, to provide free Shakespeare to our community and beyond. That's totally not really what it is, but it's in there. It's definitely in there. From the beginning, it's been necessary for us to remain free. I will answer your whole question, but I do want to
get
really
there however you want to get
make
there.
The point that that is so important to us, because those of us who find Shakespeare to be our passion and our calling, it's so important to keep that fire alive and to make it exciting and accessible to everyone. I love OSF. I think what the work that they do is incredible, but it's not accessible to everyone. You have to, the tickets are expensive. They have some performances where you can donate a can of food and see the show sure. for $10, which is so great. But for us, every performance that is outside will always be free. It's so important to have kids get to come see these plays and, fall in love with these characters and find passion in live theater, because there is a risk of that becoming a thing only for the elite. Right. And, to paraphrase a character from Stage Door, you know, theater is part of civilization and has been forever. And it's such an important part of storytelling, is such an important part of the human experience. That's before you could write, there was language and stories were passed down to the next generation. And I think that's what we're doing. It's so important. It's so important. And to make it accessible and to bring these stories to people who maybe don't think they like Shakespeare or don't get Shakespeare. You can! Shakespeare's for the masses. Shakespeare was written for the general public. It wasn't, you know, it's like everyone should be able to love that. And if you don't, that's fine. But yeah, I think that's why audiences keep coming back, because Shakespeare still resonates with everyone. The stories are timeless. The emotions are timeless. They're about love. They're about rage. They're about jealousy. They're about war. And those things are all very much present in our lives today. And it's great to be able to put Shakespeare in any time period and, you know, tell the story of Romeo and Juliet in a modern context or in an ancient context. It doesn't really matter. People yesterday, people 1,000 years ago, people 100 years from now will still fall in love and still feel like they would do anything to see that love through. That's not a weird concept for most people to grasp, you know?
Right.
So, yeah, I think that's why Shakespeare in particular resonates across the globe, across cultures, across demographics. It's the human experience.
Well said. Well, I like taking a moment to like take in the awesome answer. Brody agrees. Brody's whimpering over here. I think he's picking up on how passionate you are.
I haven't cried yet. I'm like really impressed with
like
myself.
Like you're obviously podcasting is an audio medium. Excuse me, but just to see you during that answer, you're just so embodied. Your arms are going. It's obviously the stakes are high for you.
They are. This is absolutely what I want to do with my life. I want to do Shakespeare for everyone. That's it. I'm good with that. It's like so great.
Life mission statement. Yeah. Bam. Done.
Yeah. And I feel so fortunate to be in a community where I got to be a part of the start of that.
Right.
And I get to be a part of the growth. And this is, you know, for this season, for the first year, I obviously wasn't here last year.
But you were the festival dramaturg last year.
I was that. But we're, you know, we're bringing in actors from all over the country. From the first year, every actor has been paid, which is awesome. And we're really becoming an regional theater people around the country want to work for, and that's really cool. Housing is hard to, you know, find housing for all these people who are coming from all over, but...
Yeah, why don't we take that? Why don't we approach that a little bit? Like, can you talk a little bit about the... It's sort of like... That temporary community. I mean, obviously, each time you do a piece of theater, there's that temporary community of actors and audience, but I feel that you guys are sort of, you know, whenever the ISF group is in town, it's sort of, you know, it's this gang, and you guys are a unit, and
totally.
People, like, see you and recognize you around town, and can you talk a little bit about creating that sort of temporary community of actors each summer, and how that enriches the community?
Yeah, I think there's huge potential, certainly, and already that's starting. We definitely, I mean, it brings new audiences here, having people from all over, their families, their friends come to see these plays. It's amazing. And I mean, what a place to spend your summer for these actors. It's
like, right.
Gavin, who's, playing, Sebastian in The Tempest and Aramis in Three Musketeers, was saying, you know, this is paradise. You get to come spend summer on Whidbey Island, which is like, amazing if you're
absolutely
at all
gorgeous.
Interested in the outdoors or anything. And you get to do the theater you love to do, you know? That's so special. It's an amazing opportunity for these people who are coming from all over the country, from cities, from Gavin's from Bend. They're, you know, it's like, this is so cool that
folks
we get
from
to offer
New
that.
Hampshire, New
yeah,
York.
New Hampshire, New York, Chicago, a large group of Southern Oregon University graduates this year who are all living in different places, but there's a big connection there, which is cool. Several of my classmates from college are up here this year, which is really fun and kind of weird because I grew
it's
up
like,
here.
It's
and
like
this
you
is
knew
like
me
my
this
home.
Other way,
yes.
And now you're seeing me where I grew up.
It's
and
totally
like,
strange.
Before I got to like mask the parts of my personality that like I wanted to hide, not hide, but like, you know,
but, like,
we're not fully
an adult
baked, right?
Somewhere other than here.
Yes.
Yeah. So that's funny for me, but,
you're like, guys, be cool. Be cool.
Yeah.
I'm cool now.
Yeah. Remember? I'm totally like legit. Yeah. But it's really cool. And you know, Langley will catch up. I think we have, you know, it's a young company. We're a really young company, so it's a lot of 20-somethings who are bombarding Langley with energy and
as well they should. I think.
Yeah, it's good. It's really fun. It's great. I think fun for the community to have these foreigners here to you know meet and talk to and some of them find jobs at different places,
right?
You know, and so that's really fun to...
They're participating in the local economy in more ways than...
Absolutely.
More ways than one.
Yes.
So dramaturging the fourth season And then you're back for the fifth season.
Yes.
Tell me about the roles you're playing in the current repertory season. I felt like using that voice right then. I don't know why, but...
Our sixth season. Is it six? Yeah, it is.
I forgot one.
I did... right? As You, R&J, Midsummer...
As You Like
It. Adieu.
Adieu.
And then the two last summer.
So five. Okay, so this is the sixth season.
So this is the sixth
year. I
misspoke.
I apologize.
I am playing Ariel in The Tempest, and I am playing a variety of ensemble roles in The Three Musketeers, which has been really fun. It's been fun to... It's two very different plays. Playing a non-human entity has been really a challenge to jump into. I was just saying to a friend the other night, with a character, find something to connect to that, you know, it's like...
Right.
You know, in Juliet, I totally remember that moment of falling in love. Like, that is... I get where she's coming from there. With Beatrice, the insecurity and, like, need to be really big to, you know, mask what's underneath, for sure. Like...
Can't relate to that at all.
No, not at all. What? No. So usually with these characters, there's something that I immediately...
There's a way in.
The first time I read it, it's like, okay, I get that. I have somewhere to start from. With Ariel, total mystery to me. Total mystery. I, like, oh man, was really reluctant to even start working on it. Just because I had no idea. I saw it at OSF when they did it last season. It was this my intern season. So I saw it a bunch, and yeah, just didn't know a way in. I was really excited to not play the ingenue in this play, but but super challenged by it. And Valerie, too, early on in rehearsal, she's playing Caliban, who's half human. So at least there's, like, some connection to humanity there.
Right.
But Ariel, unfortunately, in the words, says, were I human, I'm not a human. So what, like, how does Ariel experience emotion? Which there's a lot of. There's, you know, so that's been a really interesting journey to find what's okay to express and what's confusing and if there is confusion. But then I remembered that it's still a play written by a human, so there's only so much, like, actually not human that Ariel can be.
Right.
There is some humanity in her or him because it's words created by a person. So, I think that maybe I just decided to think that because it let me off the hook a little bit and, like, you know, finding something totally different, but it is true. It is. And there are moments when Ariel does seem to have feelings and need to express them.
That
and,
whole relationship with Prospero, like when am I done?
Yeah,
when am I done?
Yeah.
When are you releasing
aching
me?
Aching for freedom. Yeah. And, you know, like, there is something there. And in the words, I mean, Prospero says, moody. So, you know, that tells me I need to be moody in this moment.
Right.
So, like, what does that mean to something that's not a person? I don't know. And physically, how do you embody that? It's been a challenge for me. It's been really hard to figure that out. And I'm certainly still getting there, you know? I do not, the last couple of performances, I felt like different things click and, like, okay, that's that moment. Okay. I get that, you know, but it's been.
And you get to have a run of about 2 months, right? To discover.
Yeah. Which is great. Yeah. We close September 13th. So we've got a few more weeks of figuring that out. So
if people want more information about when they can see what, How would they find that information?
They would find that information by going to our website, islandshakespearefest.org. And there's a link to the calendar right on the homepage there.
Awesome.
We also post on Facebook what is happening, so follow us, like us on Facebook.
One of my favorite new things this year is the mac and cheese. Can we talk about how amazing that is?
Salish Kitchen is catering.
To die for.
They've got a booth at the festival every day, and they do sandwiches and some pastries and stuff, and this off-the-hook macaroni and cheese. It's so good. It's, like, really problematic. Sometimes they give us the leftovers, and it just is...
So, pro tips for attending. Let's give people some pro tips for attending ISF. You're going to want to bring cash.
Bring cash, yes.
It is free, but they're passing the hat for actors afterwards.
Yes. As I said, we... All of our actors receive a stipend at the end of the summer, which allows people from all over the place to come spend their summer here, 'cause there's money at the end. So we pass the hat after every performance, and that money is pooled and split among the actors at the end of the season. So please bring a contribution, whatever you can afford. If it's a dollar, if it's $50, we are happy to have you there, and... You know, it is free, and we want everyone to come see it and not feel like financially they can't. We don't know what people are putting in the baskets. It's not a big, you know, it's whatever you can. But if you're so inspired, bring some cash. That's great.
You can bring a picnic if you want to, but you don't have to because there is wine and beer and macaroni and sandwiches for sale.
Yeah. In the past, when we were on private land, people brought picnics all the time, and that was super great, and people could bring their own beer and wine. Because we are now on public land, we have beer and wine for sale through the Roaming Radish, but it is Washington state law prohibits people bringing their own alcohol onto public land. It is
that's just the way it is.
So please don't do that, but do... buy a bottle from Roaming Radish or buy some beer. She has a great selection. And that's a great alternative. You can certainly still bring a picnic, bring your own food. That's great. Or if you don't, the Salish Kitchen has really good options.
Stuff. It's
wonderful. Yeah.
Do you recommend people reading the play before they come? Do you think that's a personal choice?
I think that's a personal choice. I think for some people it can be a little bit tricky tuning their ear to the language.
Right.
I mean, it is hard for some people to get into that right away. And The Tempest starts off with, like, 6 pages of exposition from Prospero about how Prospero ended up on the island. So I think just maybe reading about that is enough for people or
is it
not.
Legit for people to go to Wikipedia or look at Cliff Notes?
Absolutely. I would rather do that.
So you have a little bit of a roadmap to know where you're going.
Yeah. 'Cause then I think, you know, some people would much rather just experience the play on its own as it is, and that's great. But if the words are at all intimidating, then absolutely.
Don't be shy. Google that stuff.
Google it. Ask your neighbor at intermission, you know.
What's good? I missed that. Did you see what's going on?
Yeah, like, who were those other characters that just came? Because the structure of The Tempest is very, you know, there's one scene of this group and then another group of people and then another group of people. It's not a lot of interaction among groups. So it is kind of, I think, can be tricky to figure out how they all relate. But Cliff Notes would be plenty. Or Spark Notes, whatever. Whatever's online. Yeah.
As we wind this down a little bit, I want to know what's on your bucket list? Shakespearean and otherwise, and then what's kind of coming up next for you?
I want to play every Shakespeare role again that I've played.
Okay.
Which probably I will continue to feel with everyone I play from here on out. I just, there's never enough time to figure everything out.
Right.
And so much about each character will change within the context that the play is,
absolutely, you
know,
yeah,
set in, whatever the world is, then it's going to be different, you know? So I just want to do them all again. but I really want to play, there's a lot, I really want to play Gertrude someday, the Hamlet's mother.
Yeah.
There's a lot there. I really want to play Lady M from the Scottish play, super bad. I really want to play Desdemona. I, you know, can just list, you know, the lady from all the Shakespeare plays.
And are there any, roles traditionally played by men that you'd really like? You're like, that one, that's on the list.
Yeah, I'd love to play Richard III.
Nice.
So much. I'd like to play, I mean, you know, I'd like to play Hamlet, but I think more than Hamlet, I'd like to play Richard. There's...
Yeah.
And Prince Hal.
I can totally
see
that.
Play.
Yeah.
You know, I'd like to play all of them, really.
Nice.
I'd like to play all the plays.
All the plays.
All the plays. I just want to do
roles,
them all.
All the
all
plays.
All the roles and all the plays.
So you've, congratulations on graduating from...
Thanks. Woohoo.
Well, both, I mean, Circle in the Square is such a prestigious training program, and then, you know...
I just did it backwards. I went to undergrad after I did conservatory.
Don't say backwards. You did it on your own tempo. And
I did.
In a way that best served you and your career.
And it really did. I feel like my training at Circle was... I don't have words for what I got out of that program. It's like such a great program. And so much awesome technique vocally and physically. I loved it. But coming out of it, it's only 2 years. And I think it used to be three. And in the third year, there was a lot more performance.
Ah.
And I think what I was missing from that program was putting it into practice. So then going to undergrad allowed me to, like, really hone those skills.
Sure.
SOU is also a great program, but it just gives a little taste of everything that I'd already had 2 years of, like, really in-depth stuff with. So it was a great opportunity to take that stuff that was really, really raw and, like, all over the place from Circle that I was just kind of, like, hadn't processed and put it into a cleaner way to use it, I think. So it worked for me to do it that way.
And now you've moved to Langley.
I have moved to Langley for the year. I'm really excited to be here, and I'm working with ISF. Aside from being an actor, I'm also doing some marketing and education development and trying to develop some educational outreach stuff that we can do in the rural schools in the area.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, we're really excited about getting out there and bringing more Shakespeare and classical words to young people and building that excitement. Washington schools need that.
Yes,
so
absolutely.
Badly. And yeah, so we that's on the agenda. So I'm excited to be here this year to work on some development stuff and continue the growth of this company with our very small staff of Rose Woods, Michelle Durr, and myself, and our really awesome board of directors. So that's on my agenda this year. And then planning on moving to Seattle or staying here. Not really sure right now. Maybe back to New York. Who knows? But I'm right now really, really committed to this company and helping us grow into a destination. And it's great.
Congratulations.
But it's really fun to be in Langley right now.
Yay. So I'm going to put you on the spot a little bit here.
Okay.
I was wondering if you would end this interview by giving us a little bit of Shakespeare.
Sure.
Anything. Anything you want to do. But maybe tell us what it is.
Okay. Let's see. Well, none of Ariel's things really would make sense out of context.
Do you want to give us a little, do you have any Juliet you want to do?
Yeah, can I look at it?
Yeah,
can I
absolutely. Look something up,
and I don't know if I could, like, remember things right off the top of my head, but, let's see, what's my favorite? Gallop a Pace is always a good one.
Do it! I love it.
She's not super sad yet. She's pretty happy at that point, so, you know, we can do that. It would be weird to do it sitting.
You can stand up if you want. Sitting. Yeah, okay. You can stand up. Go for it. The mic will pick you up. You have all that great vocal training, right?
I didn't warm up yet today. But yeah, it's cool.
It's going to be brilliant.
Okay. Gallop apace, you fiery-footed steeds, towards Phoebus' lodging. Such a wagoner as Phaethon would whip you to the west and bring in cloudy night immediately. Spread thy closed curtain, love-performing night, that runaway's eyes may wink, and Romeo... leap to these arms untalked of and unseen. Lovers can see to do their amorous rites by their own beauties. Or, if love be blind, it best agrees with night. Come, civil knight, thou sober-suited matron all in black, and learn me how to lose a winning match played for a pair of stainless maidenhoods. Hood my unmanned blood, bathing in my cheeks with thy black mantle, till strange love grow bold. Think true love acted simple modesty. Come, night, come, Romeo, come, thou day in night, for thou wilt lie upon the wings of night whiter than new snow on a raven's back. Come, gentle night, come, loving, black-browed knight, give me my Romeo, and when he shall die, take him and cut him out in little stars, and he will make the face of heaven so fine that all the world will be in love with night and pay no worship to the garish sun. Oh, I have bought the mansion of love but not possessed it, and though I am sold... not yet enjoyed. So tedious is this day, as is the night before some festival, to an impatient child that hath new robes and may not wear them. Here comes my nurse, and she brings news, and every thought that speaks but Romeo's name speaks heavenly eloquence.
Thank you so much for that. I'm going to put you on the spot. And thank you for being on the podcast. Everyone, you're going to want to go to Island Shakespeare Festival's website and see both The Tempest and Three Musketeers before they close in mid-September. Yeah. And break a leg tonight. Thanks. Today for your show.
Yeah. Thank you.